Hello, and welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. I'm Infralogic's America's Managing Editor, Jonathan Carmody, and I'm joined today with Omri Gainsberg, a partner with Meridiam North America and Chief Operating Officer for the Americas. Omri, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Meridiam is a very particular kind of investor, operating typically in core infrastructure assets across the globe. And Omri is obviously responsible for the Americas investments. Meridiam's approach emphasizes building long-term holdings and managing assets for the long-term. So Omri, I want to start off by asking, how does this philosophy shape your investment decisions and relationships with public partners compared to firms that take a shorter-term, private equity-style approach to infrastructure?
Maybe first of all, the very fact that we invest long-term, I think by definition means that we make long-term commitments. We have a 20-year track record that I'd say is credible. So by definition, we're investing in the sorts of projects that by their nature require long-term commitments, not only to build and deliver the initial asset, but also to maintain that asset at a good quality of service over, you know, usually a generation or two generations. So not just measured in years. I'm not so sure how many public authorities really appreciate the short-term kind of PE or M&A approach, or whether they can make those types of long-term commitments. But what that means for us in practice is that our investments really depend on a few things to be successful over that long term. Two points come to mind. One is essentiality. So what we mean by that is we need to focus on investments or projects that really meet everyday needs, right? People's everyday needs as they go about their lives, fixing up our roads, modernizing our airports like our LaGuardia Terminal B, redevelopment, ensuring sustainable water supply for growing cities, et cetera. So really meeting things that are delivering essential services for people in their communities. The second thing I'd point out is really finding the alignment of interests with our public partners. So that means our financial performance really is directly linked to the performance of those underlying assets. So if we are delivering a good service, whether that means well-maintained roads or civic buildings that are well-maintained, clean, the lights are working well, the elevators, the escalators are working well over the long term, then that means that we hit our target financial performance. So I think that really works well from in the eyes of public partners and certainly the communities that we serve. And that's, I think, led us to develop very strong, long-lasting relationships with public partners of all shapes and sizes all over the country.
Okay, fantastic. And in terms of the kind of assets you've invested in, we've seen Meridiam participate in a lot of the managed lanes projects in the US, particularly with success being realized in Texas and Virginia, and more recently with the SR400 project in Georgia, which I believe reached financial close for about $11 billion, making it one of the largest ever transportation P3s in the US. Talk to me a little bit, Omri, about what lessons you're learning from these projects over the now decades that Meridiam's been investing in the United States. And how are these lessons informing your current pipeline, considering the opportunities that are available in states like Georgia, Tennessee, and North Carolina?
Yeah, thanks for mentioning our project in Georgia. We're obviously extremely proud of our partnership with the Georgia Department. Obviously, we're committed to delivering the SR400 express lanes, which I think, as you pointed out, it's a big mile marker, as it were, for the industry. So while I can't necessarily comment on ongoing procurements in some of the states you mentioned, what I can say, and I think this extends across sectors, even beyond managed lanes, there is a willingness, I think what we've seen recently, there's a willingness to share best practices across states, across governments and procuring agencies. We also see a lot of innovation, not only in the way that we address certain types of risks in project delivery, but also in the nature of the procurements themselves. You mentioned PPP, but now that can mean many different things and different types of approaches, whether it's a pre-development agreement or some sort of progressive approach to getting to a P3 contract. So certainly a lot of innovation. And what that does is, I believe, and we've seen this, it's really enabling a lot of good competition which is key, right? Public authorities want to see good competition for their projects because that's the way that they ensure the best value for money when they procure projects and attract private partners to help them finance those projects. So that's, I think that's really key. And that's extending across managed lanes. Certainly some other states are starting to look at it. Pennsylvania, South Carolina have been a few that have come up of late. I would say in particular, one trend that we're seeing, and this is something that's been a feature of managed lane procurements, but we're starting to see that extend to other sectors, is that states and local governments are really bringing partners like us earlier in their procurement process or their planning process to really bring out the best design and development ideas. And places, sectors rather, like airports or water and even other sectors, we're starting to see that more often. And I think that's contributing to more opportunities writ large across the industry, across the country, but also in terms of some of the new, or rather I should say, local governments and procuring authorities that would be new to the PPP world. So they're starting to see the success that the model can bring, especially when you can bring some innovative ideas and good competition to their procurements.
And in terms of the financing of the projects, we wrote a piece recently talking about the PABS limit in North America, the public activity bonds. And looking at those, it's very interesting to see that the limit is so tight on PABS. And there's been a lot of discussion about perhaps raising that limit for the SR400 project in Georgia. I think you raised about $3 billion through PABS issuance. So what changes would you like to see to the PABS regime? What would be the message to Washington about potentially increasing the cap or removing the cap entirely? What would Meridiam's position be on that in Washington?
Yeah, Jonathan, you raise a good point. More PABS would certainly be helpful for these projects. They do support project feasibility. The case in point is SR400, raised $3.4 billion. They are a clear source of good liquidity from the public markets for project financing, particularly long-term, affordable project financing. And that, I think that's key. So we'd certainly like to see in the next round of legislation that's going to be a focus for next year, we'd like to see that being addressed one way or another. More generally, though, we're supportive of any, I would say, any policy that incentivizes the use of long-term financing instruments. Certainly that's, whether that's PABS or TIFIA or RIF financing or other types of financing, I think that's beneficial generally for the market. And we've seen some changes in that direction recently. We would expect to hear similar advocacy from the rest of the industry and including some of our partners in the public sector world. So not only the DOTs, but more generally across organizations like AASHTO, that we know that's a key focus for them as well. So we'd love to see more. That would be my position.
And in terms of other recent legislation as well, what was the impact for an investor like yourselves of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act? And these were both programs that under the Biden administration provided much greater funds for infrastructure spending. And I think really importantly highlighted the essential nature of infrastructure for economic development in the United States in a way that perhaps we hadn't seen under previous administrations.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I would perhaps say that one of the key focus areas for infrastructure really stays at the state and local level. So it's true that at the federal level, a lot of policy or legislation can be put in place to support that. But I think the broader effect of the IIJA, as an example, is that it has allowed new types of conversations and some of the innovation that I mentioned earlier to be applied across states and local governments, which are really the key to delivering, procuring and delivering infrastructure in this country. So any new legislation or policy on any level that supports those agencies, state and local governments, to address their capital programs, to accelerate those, to scale those up and help them in project delivery, I think is going to be welcome. And I think generally we see that as a broad consensus in the industry. Everybody knows that. I mentioned AASHTO a little bit ago. We know that the new AASHTO leadership is very focused on project delivery. That's a key for any procuring authority, only because resources are going to be limited. And so any legislation that's going to be supportive of that, I think, is going to be welcome. I'd also like to point out, I think the other policy or set of policies that we'd like to see is in one way or another helping to address in a considered and measured way, permitting reform. right? That's another key and perhaps more specific element to project delivery that will help speed things up. And you're starting to see that coming out of Congress. We'll see how that shapes up. But anything that gives more certainty to timelines and managing some delivery risks, particularly around NEPA, I think will be very welcome.
That's certainly an area where a lot of people talk about the impediments that permitting causes to project deployment, project delivery. So yeah, that's certainly something that everybody is concerned about and keeping a close eye on Washington to see how those discussions pan out. Looking ahead though, what do you see as the biggest opportunities and challenges for P3s in U.S. transportation over the next decade?
That's a good question. There's clearly so much still to do. Congestion is still a real issue, not only on some of the urban highways, but generally across cities. I think it's a critical issue in a lot of big cities. There's a recent INRIC report, and their data shows that hours lost to congestion is actually increasing in a lot of cities, everything from Chicago to Philly to Atlanta to right here in DC, where we're based, just to name a few examples. Congestion is worsening despite some of the recent investments. So that means that we're just not deploying new projects quickly enough to manage and address that congestion. And obviously that has economic impacts across the country. Elsewhere, I think you'll probably see more in airports. We're certainly seeing that everything from some of the landside facilities. So, you know, things like the consolidated rent-a-car facilities that we build and manage with our Conrack Solutions platform, like we're currently building in Reno, Nevada, but also modernizing terminals. So, you know, the LaGuardia Terminal B project I mentioned earlier, that's been a big mile marker as well for the industry. I think you'll start to see airports look to that. We've certainly had a couple of conversations with authorities around the country around how we did that and what were the benefits and why, in that case, the Port Authority opted for a P3 structure. So I think that's certainly an opportunity, really driven by the demand for better passenger experiences, but also, again, increasing demand or volume across airports across the country. So I think those are probably some of the bigger, at least in the transportation space, some of the bigger areas of opportunity. I think the challenge, to come to your question, is going to be in making sure that we have significant construction capacity to address those challenges, or rather those opportunities. So construction capacity, and particularly managing some of the roadblocks or permitting challenges that I mentioned earlier, are going to be key as well to making sure that we address some of our critical needs in the transportation space.
It's very interesting that you mentioned airports, because at the start of December, the U.S. Department of Transportation issued a request for information to explore the revitalization of the Washington Dulles International Airport, which is obviously a major hub in the United States. We also saw the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey discuss a potential P3 for Newark Terminal B. It's a project that we at Infologic have been tracking for a long time. So that's very exciting to see that for the space, the success of the airports here in New York being revitalized and modernized through P3 programs has really been exciting to watch as somebody who lives in New York and travels regularly through those facilities.
I hope you're using LaGuardia Terminal B.
I am. It's very nice. Lovely airport. Lovely. JFK, LaGuardia, great airports. I hope Newark gets better. So Terminal B in Newark should be a big upgrade. In terms of rail projects, Omri, I think one of the things that's been disappointing in the United States is how high-speed rail has really struggled. California is obviously advancing with its project. There have been projects talked about in Texas. There's the Brightline West project between Las Vegas and Los Angeles. Just broadly thinking about high-speed rail in the United States, do you see that's going to be an area of greater focus going forward? We know that the administration, for political reasons, has denied funding to certain projects. But do you think that there's prospects that the high-speed rail business in North America will pick up in the coming years?
Okay. Again, these are questions first and foremost for states primarily, but also local authorities. And I would just encourage, when we have our conversations with the relevant authorities, we encourage them to really consider very carefully the ridership needs and whether high-speed lines would really encourage a significant modal shift. In other words, will the introduction of a high-speed line shift people from taking their cars or taking planes between two cities? Is that something that will have a positive net economic benefit or even socioeconomic benefit? We do try to have those conversations with authorities also introducing the kind of the long-term economic perspective. For someone like us, that's very important because we wouldn't just be investing in the initial development and delivery of the asset, but also the long-term asset. We would certainly hope to see these projects be successful by having increasing ridership over time and having an increasing economic impact. So maybe more concretely, will that high-speed line create better connectivity? Will it create more jobs? Will you see regional economic growth? Will you see some other nodes along the high-speed line grow as a result of that? We've seen that elsewhere in the world. So we're speaking from experience here. For example, the high-speed line between Paris and Bordeaux that we've been operating for nearly a decade. So we bring that, I would say we try to bring that experience to bear. And I think that's something that authorities are welcoming. I don't want to comment on any specific projects, but that's probably one of the keys to making sure that these are successful over the long term.
That brings us back to a topic we were talking about previously about the future of transportation and a point you made to me about whether technology really is serving a public need. If it's a nice luxury opportunity, then perhaps there's a business model, but you guys at Meridiam are much more focused on addressing community needs, you said. So I wonder if you could just talk, Omri, about that focus on technology now as we start to look at things like autonomous vehicles and electric vehicles and how you're trying to implement and include those pieces of technology in your planning for your projects.
Yeah, we've always been doing that as a essential part of delivering a better public service. So if it comes to roads, for example, can we institute or rather incorporate better technology systems that can track, whether it's radar or other systems that can track incidents and improve our incident response? Safety is the top priority in our transportation assets. We want to make sure that if there are technologies, whether equipment or supplies or services, that we can incorporate that improve safety across our assets, that's a good investment. If these investments produce better economic benefits or improve jobs or make construction more efficient, that's worth it. That's always been part of our investment philosophy or investment approach. And it's not just limited to transportation, but all of our types of assets and sectors in which we invest. So it's not investing in technology for technology's sake, but really making sure that it is delivering a better quality of service, particularly for essential services. As I mentioned earlier, the essentiality is key. So if the technology can help us address that essentiality and produce a better service, then it's worth the investment.
Meridiam doesn't obviously just invest in transportation assets. Obviously, it's a major focus of your activity here in the Americas. But just as a final point, Omri, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the other opportunities outside of the transport sector in North America. Just this summer, Meridiam launched M Street Fiber, consolidating your fiber assets in the United States. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about Meridiam's interest in telecommunications, digital infrastructure, and some of the social infrastructure projects out there as well.
Let me first go back to one of the points I made earlier. One thing that we're seeing in infrastructure writ large in the US and in North America is that public authorities are being much more innovative in how they procure their large capital projects. So not just classic PPPs, as we've seen over the last few decades, but there's now a wide variety of permutations of PPPs and similar long-term contracts. One of the features of that then is that we're being called in earlier during the planning phase to help authorities design and develop projects that are suitable to attract private capital, private financing. So yeah, you mentioned some of the sectors. One area that we're seeing, which is relatively new, actually is in a public utility space, public power, public water. That's a great example. This is an area that hasn't typically used these types of contracts in a more classic sense, but both water and electric utilities at the municipal level or the co-op level, they have large CapEx needs. They need to invest in new capacity. They need to upgrade their systems. They need to meet load growth. But they also have deferred maintenance needs that are growing and they haven't been able to address under more traditional models, sometimes because of the sheer limited resources that they have, development or capital resources that they have available to them. So we've had now a number of opportunities that we're looking at. We're very excited about in these sectors. And again, these are essential services. So very much in line with our investment philosophy. That means delivering things like projects that improve grid resilience or increasing the water treatment capacity for a municipality that might be growing or upgrading existing water distribution networks. This is a relatively new area, I would say, to the kind of more classic PPP space, but even though they may not be using those terms, we're seeing very similar contracts. That is a new exciting space or sector.
So just to finish on an optimistic note, in terms of fundraising, Meridiam closed its fourth North American fund above target this year. Back in September, we reported that you raised about $1.8 billion for MENA 4. Could you just talk a little bit, Omri, about the relationships with US LPs? Obviously, they're enthusiastic about Meridiam's achievements and Meridiam's strategy. What are you hearing from LPs about their interest in infrastructure and what they want to see you do with this new fund and this new money to improve US infrastructure?
I think, and this has been true not necessarily only for this fund over our 20-year history, our LPs are really excited by the fact that we are primarily focused in building new assets and not necessarily just buying and selling assets, which you alluded to earlier, but a lot of people can do that. I think it's much more difficult to work directly in building, developing and building assets and then managing those assets, delivering that service over the long term. Certainly, there's a very strong financial case to be made, and our track record speaks to that. And I think investors have seen that and why we've enjoyed support, long-term support from our LPs in the US, but all over the world in our latest fund. But what they also, I think, get excited about is that we are really having an impact with what we're building. So, you know, whether that means taking LaGuardia Terminal B from a quote-unquote third world airport to the best new airport in the world, that's the sort of impact that we like to have. And I think certainly they deliver the financial returns, but I think it's also a good investment that more generally that our LPs have enjoyed. So that's probably the biggest takeaway or one of the biggest takeaways in our conversations with LPs. And I think they are excited for us to continue to remain focused in this area and delivering essential public services through new assets with public partners in particular.
Omri, thank you so much for an enlightening conversation. It's been a real pleasure to hear more about Meridiam's strategy in North America and your vision for American infrastructure going forward. Thank you so much for taking the time to join Crossroads.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So I've been your host, Jonathan Carmody. Thank you for listening to Crossroads, available anywhere you get your podcasts. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.